at both Motorola and the National Laboratory, and that is our interests in understanding proton conduction mechanisms in these polymer electrolyte membranes. And we're going to talk about two modeling thrusts. They're not entirely separate, and these relate to both that done on a molecular scale and that also using the formalisms of statistical mechanics. Having had some time in industry, we have very specific goals, and the goals of this work have been twofold. The first is to obtain a molecular level understanding of structure and mechanism of these materials. It's well known that for the polymer electrolyte membrane fuel cell to emerge into the marketplace, into the mass market, out of the niche and specialized and very expensive applications, we need improved materials. A substantial review article published a year and a half ago, Brian Steele at Imperial College London, Nature magazine, specified specifically that the three thrusts towards improved materials in these devices must be the membrane itself, the catalysts, and the bipolar black backplates. Our efforts have mostly been with respect to the membranes. Very recently we have a first principles based series of calculations on methanol oxidation on platinum surfaces under review in Physical Review Letters, but today I'm just going to concentrate on our work with respect to membranes. So we want this mechanistic understanding, but we also want to correlate between this information, structure and mechanism of these materials, membranes, with their properties. This will allow us a nice bridging, and the important bridging, to macroscopic measurable quantities with our somewhat lofty impact that we want to play a role in material design engineering. We don't believe in a virtual laboratory where the calculations stand alone, but coupled with careful characterization experiments, the modeling can provide means of pursuing various specific goals towards improving the performance of these materials. So what we want to first do is understand how the existing materials go, operate, and function, and then participate in the proposition of new materials with improved properties. Well, what can be said about this fuel cell? We've seen this. So basically our central component, this is a direct hydrogen fuel cell. The things that we'll be interested in are obviously, because the existing membranes require water, now there is some thrust towards development of fully polymeric or water-free membranes, but this talk will just cover issues concerning materials that require water to exhibit the high proton conductivities required to complete this electrical circuit. We will bear in mind the fact that in an operating fuel cell, we have a gradient in the concentration of the water, so we'll want to understand these materials as a function of their level of hydration. We'll also want to be concerned about this phenomena, somewhat yet unexplained, that is this coupled drag of water with the protonic current, electroosmosis. The analog system, direct methanol fuel cell, where, as indicated yesterday, the oxidation mechanism is much more complicated. And in addition, we have this issue concerned with the permeability of the methanol. For every methanol molecule that escapes, that is not oxidized, we lose 6 electrons. Where does the methanol go? What does it do to the morphology of the polymer? Some of these questions are things that we want to be concerned with. We know that oxidation, and to some extent reduction, will be improved by elevating the temperature of either the direct hydrogen fuel cell or the direct methanol fuel cell. But this will impose some problems in terms of the stability of the system. So we want to understand temperature effects. And with the desire to elevate the temperature to improve the catalysis, we will want to be concerned with membranes that operate with minimal amounts of water. So when we're pursuing our goals of trying to understand mechanism and function, will want to look at even very low hydration levels. All right, some of the basic sulfonic acid-based membranes, and this is more than just sulfonic acid membranes. The archetypical system is this DuPont-registered trademark polymer, Nafion. A fully fluorinated system consisting of a backbone that's hydrophobic, it's essentially Teflon, with randomly attached side chains, double ether, fully fluorinated, ending in a sulfonic acid group. Dow, some years ago, had their own short side chain version. This has since been bought by DuPont because of their inability to make this from the patent. This has a, and that is absolutely solid, I can tell you, because I spoke to the man who spent, who was in charge of their high-temperature membrane program for quite a number of months, and they pursued it very vigorously. But as per usual with patents, there's not sufficient information to actually duplicate. So they bought the licensing rights for this system, and they make it now under their own label. We're going to talk about both of these fully fluorinated systems. And obviously, the issue is, why would DuPont pursue the short side chain version? What are the differences in the application of the short side chain version of this fully fluorinated system? We'll try to address some of those questions in this talk. Coming from Clemson University, Daryl DeMarteau's group is this bis-trifluoral sulfonoacid imid. In the gas phase, the monomer is even strong, of greater acidic strength than these monomeric units. And so this was pursued somewhat. And here, this is not a sulfonic acid, but is actually an acid imid. Finally, there, as we saw this yesterday also, is the hydrocarbon-based, where we've replaced the backbone from being a fluorinated system to this aromatic backbone system, consisting of ether groups and ketone groups. So it's a polyether, ether, ketone, ketone. We can vary in the monomer the number of ketones and, of course, the number of ether groups. I mean, one of the obvious reasons for moving to this system is its reduced cost over a fully fluorinated system. So we'd like to develop some understanding. We've pursued these, plus other membranes I'm not going to talk about, but I want to focus on some information about these. The key ingredient with respect to all of these is they all contain an acidic proton. They are all acids in the basic Bronsted-Lowry definition of an acid. And that is a compound that can donate a proton. So to think of these systems as one of the basic issues here, and I make a point of this because of some of the discussion yesterday, if these protons could not dissociate, you don't have an acid, and you will not see conductivity. All of these systems have proton conductivity, even without water, and even at very low water contents. So the protons are mobile. Well, I've said something about the chemistry. That's really the easy part. What about the morphology? And by this, we mean the structure of this polymer when we start to add water to it. We know that the morphology changes as a function of water, and when we began looking at this area 7 years ago, there was a lot of controversy. And I'm not saying that we've totally removed the controversy, but there are a lot of controversy in terms of what the morphology is. We're dealing with a heterogeneous system, a system that depends on temperature for its morphology, a system that depends on hydration for its morphology. All of these polymers that we showed you exhibit slightly different morphologies. How do we get at a probe at this system? If we're going to understand how to develop new systems, we have to know something about the existing system. One of the significant probes, and this is relatively recent stuff, we saw some of the conclusions from this result, is the small-angle X-ray scattering experiments of Klaus-Dieter Kreuer, Max Planck Institute in Stuttgart, where in this particular plot, we're comparing Nafion and peak. And what we see in the ionomer peak, distinguishing the two, I mean, understand this. From simply a Sachs experiment, you cannot know precisely what the morphology is. There is no experimental probe today that has given us a complete understanding of the morphology of these systems. They all require some modeling. But when we compare systems, so the information is to compare different hydrations, compare different polymeric systems, and try and understand what this implies in terms of its morphology. These are nanophase-separated materials. The hydrophobic domains, the backbone material, separate from the hydrophilic domains, that which contains the sulfonic acid group. So when we compare these two systems, we see a broadening of this ionomer peak in the peak system, and this with some modeling. And it's important that there's a bunch of assumptions that have gone into this. We get some understanding of the characteristic separation length of the domains, hydrophobic and hydrophilic, and we also get some idea of the separation of the sulfonic acid groups. But this requires the input and the assumptions of this modeling. Okay? And I stress that because others have other interpretation. And it's not ascertained fully. So we're dealing with a very difficult system. We've seen this figure. This is an condition based on the modeling and the experimental efforts of Clouster-Ducroyer, comparing Nafion, fully fluorinated system, with the aromatic system. We see distinctions in the size of the channels, diameters of these domains that contain the water and the protons. We see differences in the branching, the presence of possibly dead-end channels, the connectivity of the channels, separation of the sulfonate groups, and also possibly some differences in the acidity. Within this model, we can look at possibly three distinct length scales that will be relevant in terms of understanding the mechanisms of proton conduction in these materials. The first is reactions that occur on a molecular scale, sub-nanometer, space charge effects that may be up to a 1 nanometer, and then finally some percolation. For my purposes, as a computational person, primarily, we have established a hierarchy of modeling in terms of how we look at these systems. At the lowest scale is the acidity of the functional groups. We want to see what's the difference in terms of how a proton is dissociated, how a proton is stabilized within the aqueous environment, and eventually how a proton is transported. At this first scale, we'd like to submit that ab initio explicit water electronic structure calculations are a valid way for selecting and probing and understanding things which occur in the first hydration shell, dissociation and transfer. These are simply static calculations. They have limitations in their applicability. We're obviously not able to look at the entire polymer, but just, as it were, the business end or hydrophilic portion of the polymer. To look at dynamics, we do what are called ab initio molecular dynamics simulations, where we're concerned about the sharing of the proton between these acid groups, between the sulfonate groups. Finally, then, to connect to something that the experimentalists can measure as a characteristic of the properties of these materials, we take a look and we seek to derive a model that will predict the self-diffusion, proton self-diffusion coefficient. This is something, again, comes from pulse field gradient NMR experiments. So this stage of the modeling is then finally the bridging of what we've learned in the first two and also what comes from other independent experiments in terms of the characterization of the morphology to something that the experimentalists can measure. And there are two thrusts. One is to understand the character of the water, realizing that the water in these polymers is different than bulk water. And this will have a consequence on the proton conduction mechanisms. The other is then to calculate, using statistical mechanics, a friction coefficient for a proton moving within one of these water and ion domains. All right, well, I've used this term first principles or ab initio. What do we mean by this? For the computational chemist, it has a very specific meaning. And by ab initio, we mean that we resort to the most central equation of chemistry, which is the time-independent Schrödinger equation. For those who aren't chemists, or even physicists, we can state fairly emphatically that it is esoteric chemical phenomena indeed for which this equation, this general eigenfunction, eigenvalue equation, will not have relevance and information and insight in terms of the problem. We are seeking through this equation information about the structure, understanding that within psi is embedded all of the information of the structure of these systems through interactions then between the polymer and water. We're going to probe, we'll use this equation to probe acid-base chemistry. This is a very difficult equation, obviously, to solve. In fact, can only be solved for the trivial case of a one-electron system. We want multi-electron systems. But for the last 40 years or so, computational chemists and physicists have developed substantial means of solving this equation for multi-electron systems. In fact, 1998 saw the Nobel Prize in Chemistry given to two individuals who spent their essential lifetime working out means of solving this equation. We will use that which they have done. In addition, this is time independent. To get dynamics, we will couple this with Newton's second law, whereby we will calculate energies on the fly, and from those energies compute forces, and then move our atoms around. And this is this ab initio molecular dynamics. Finally, there is the central equation in statistical mechanics. And because we're interested in transport, you will see historically that this equation lies at the foundation of most transport theories. In fact, there are a number of analogs to this equation outside the context of statistical mechanics. We saw this equation yesterday. Those mass transport equations that Keith showed you yesterday are the analogs for conservation of mass to this Liouville equation, which is a statement in the conservation of the phase space. The importance and distinction between the two is, while as in a transport equation, mass transport, conservation, we only need be concerned with instantaneous positions of things moving, here we will be concerned, our density distribution function will not only depend on position, but also on momentum. And with this equation, again a very difficult equation, in fact can only be solved for trivial cases, we will seek to do this bridging. Statistical mechanics, I would like to submit, is the natural way to bridge that which occurs on a molecular or even atomistic scale with that which can be measured macroscopically. Therefore, although it is a difficult business, it is the appropriate means in which to pursue this. And from this, then, we'll calculate relative permittivities of the water, realizing that that will give us information on the character of this water as we change morphology, as we change our local chemistry, and also a means of calculating this proton self-diffusion coefficient. Yes?
Can you say a few words, where do the boundary conditions, if any, enter these equations? Because when you have a working device, you have boundary conditions, an applied field, concentration gradient.
Yeah. Some of these details will come out further on in the talk. Very valid question, because these equations, of course, cannot be solved exactly for the systems. So the limitations we're going to see is when we do any of this modeling work, we take the material ex situ from the fuel cell because the experiments that we're wishing to compare to are materials properties. So the material is taken out of the fuel cell and we make our characterization experiments and we do our modeling ex situ. So one of the obvious things is we have a simpler system where we just focus on the material properties. So with this aspect of applied electric fields, we don't have to worry about that. Right now. Now, the point of doing this difficult modeling, although in many respects this equation and the means of solving this is going to become more and more a typical type of tool that is used in engineering circles because of the availability of hardware and software and so on. The advantage of this is that we make no intentional attempt to fit any experimental data. And we don't have any adjustable parameters. So the payoff, which when it comes to materials, and really if you're going to explore new materials, is our predictive capability. All right. One of the first things that we probed, so we'll jump right into this at this first scale, is the conformation of the Nafion side chain in the presence of water. Now, literature some 20 years ago has quite a bit of controversy in terms of where is the water relative to this side chain, and therefore what is the consequence of the side chain. One of the things that we were able to do is we obtained two minimum energy conformations. Now, we solve that H psi equals E psi for the minimum energy conformation, realizing that this equilibrium structure is the relevant structure for understanding the structure and mechanism of these components in the actual material. Now, we take an isolated system, so we're just looking at the side chain. We found essentially two isoenergetic structures, one where it is folded, the other where it is unfolded. The main difference is in the position of the ether oxygens relative to the carbon-carbon bond. Here they are gauche, and here they are trans. There's also some distinction in this terminal part. We were able to show, with our calculations, that to unfold this side chain to this one requires only about 4.3 kilocalories per mole, something that is obtainable with water. So in the presence of sufficient water in the Nafion membrane, we have unfolding of the side chains. Now, what about the interaction of the side chains with water specifically? Well, let's just look at this. This is a previous calculation I want to say something about. This now is the Dow side chain. So we have a polymeric fragment with some of the backbone and two Dow short side chains. This is an exceedingly difficult structure to obtain. And the calculations in this little series that we're going to show you represent approximately 4 months of computing on 16 processors continuously. So it is computationally expensive. What we were able to show is, with respect to these two fragments, there are two minimum energy conformations, global minimums, that are very different in structure. One, the side chains are separated quite substantially. The other, the side chains interact. In fact, this one, there are two hydrogen bonds formed between the side chains. The telltale story and relevance is the difference in the energies of these two conformations. This one, where we have established this hydrogen bonding, this interaction of the side chains, the terminal parts, is favored by 12.2 kilocalories per mole, a very substantial amount of energy. And therefore, when we consider this system, when it is dry, perhaps even nearly dry, and I'll show you some nearly dry calculations a little later, there is substantial evidence from these calculations to suggest that the side chains interact with one another. So when your polymer is essentially dry, it's not that the sulfonates are all separated. And this will have definite consequences on this material under very little water. But in fact, they interact with one another. This is very much more the stable configuration. Yes?
This calculation is for the inaction between two side chains. What about when I have inaction with multiple other side chains?
Yeah. That cannot be probed with this technique. And one of the reasons it cannot be is the computational demands of this. These types of calculations typically scale somewhere in the order of n squared, n cubed, where n is the number of electrons that are treated in the system. And in such a large system like this, to find these two conformations took nearly 4 months of work on 16 processors. Okay, now as we get faster processors, larger machines, we're going to be able to. But clearly, you can't beat this scaling limit. And there are efforts to overcome this by reformulating these equations. But nevertheless, we're somewhat hindered in what we can do. It's an important point. All right. Now there's this question. Yes?
When you do this quantum mechanically, I don't know whether you've done configuration or action or whatever, but how much of an advantage is it doing it that way as opposed to using a molecular mechanics model?
Well, we're going to show that. This talk will demonstrate that. Cutting to the issue here is things like dissociation of the proton, transfer of the proton, stabilization of the proton, separation of the proton cannot be explored using classical molecular dynamics potentials, because that kind of information is simply not there. And really, in these kinds of systems, we don't have a real good understanding of what potentials we should be using. Okay. Now, I've seen quite a bit. In fact, reviewed a paper very recently. It's people, you know, from Boston University who did a pretty good job with molecular dynamics. And yet there are a lot of the important ingredients that are missing. But what it can also be stated is, if you use classical MD or molecular mechanics, and we did when we first started this, you almost assure yourself you will find no new information, nothing that you did not know already. And what I would like to tell you here is, and show you, that we can find new information, important information, that will tell us something about where to go in terms of building a better memory. Okay, the hydrophilicity of the ether oxygens. Again, a controversial thing based on some IR spectrum that was done 20 years ago by Michael Falk. Okay, I've gone backwards. We took an isolated fragment of the side chain of Nafion with the oxygen and these two fluorinated groups. We brought a water molecule in from various conformations, differences, and so on, and again sought for the minimum energy conformation. The details of this are, seeing you asked the question about configuration interaction, is this is a hybrid density functional Hartree-Fock treatment under a local basis set approximation of Gaussian functions. So we don't do CI, but we do state-of-the-art density functional theory. What we were able to ascertain with this series of calculations is the water molecule does not form a hydrogen bond with the ether group. And the importance is this, is that in the presence of water in the Nafion system, the side chain is not hydrophilic, with the exception of the terminal part. So water does not aggregate up the side chain. However, in a more recent calculation that was part of a patent that the company issued based on my computational work, and this is only just a very small ingredient of this, for a new membrane applicable for direct methanol fuel cells. I'm not going to say much about it. We can talk about it if there's some interest in that. If we replace the fluorines with hydrogens, we do form a hydrogen bond. This is not a hydrogen bond. The OO distance is too long, and the conformation is wrong. This is a hydrogen bond. So we have a means of ascertaining hydrophilicity and the formation of hydrogen bonds. And this is the point. When we say a system is hydrophilic, on a molecular scale, what do we mean by that? Something that's hydrophilic is that which forms a hydrogen bond. And a hydrogen bond, in this context, can be rationalized on the basis of orbital interaction theory, a central underpinning to a lot of organic chemistry. Essentially, what we have here is a partial donation of electron density from this oxygen, specifically from the highest occupied non-bonding molecular orbital, with the OH antibonding orbital. So we have this partial electron density and a stabilization that occurs. If we have the right symmetry and we have the right energy levels of these orbitals, we will form a hydrogen bond. And if not, we will not. Now, along this same line is then the question of the acidity of the sulfonic acid group. In this series of calculations, we looked at simply the terminal part of either the Dow or Nafion membrane. This fluorinated, this is the triflic acid or trifluoromethane sulfonic acid. We systematically added water molecules and sought for the minimum energy conformation. Of some significance is the fact with one and two water molecules, there is no dissociation of the proton. There is some increase in the length of the OH bond, but no dissociation. When we added three water molecules, we see dissociation of the proton. Now, you could ask, well, this is a small fragment. How does that possibly relate to the membrane? Nafion membranes prepared isopiastically, we did this experiment ourselves, as a function of hydration, plotted versus the activity of water, and perhaps J.U. showed a plot similar to this, I wasn't clear from the axis, but such a plot will show a change in the slope as one goes from two waters to three waters. This story is continued through four, five, and six waters, yes.
Are you stating that all of these effects are quantum mechanical in nature, meaning that if you take known models of water like X5 or others, and reasonable, you know, ion-ion potentials, or you will not get any of these associations?
No. You will not see this distinguishing difference. Nope. And even more important, what we see here at 6 waters. 4 and 5 resemble the case with 3. Dissociation of the proton. Here we measure OO distances, which are typical hydrogen bonding measures, increasing. But a very curious thing happens when we've added the 6th water molecule. And we've tried this from many different conformations, and I can ascertain that this is established truth. With 6 waters, we have separation of the proton from direct electrostatic interaction of the corresponding anion. We have the formation of this intermediate water layer. So the minimum energy, the preferred conformation, is with the proton separated. Ideally, in a membrane then, and again, if we go back to this isopiestic data, you will see again a change in the slope between 5 and 6 water molecules. And so, in consequence, what we'd like is, if we're going to see a material that conducts protons well, we want dissociation of the proton early with minimal amount of water, and we want separation of the proton. What if we change the local chemistry? This, then, is the analog for the peak membranes. This is the paratoluene sulfonic acid, an aromatic system. If we compare the aromatic system then with the fluorinated system, we see when we measure the OO distance at 6 water molecules that the separation is greater in the fluorinated case. Why? This is a quantitative assessment of this. Here we plot the total electronic charge on the oxygen atoms versus the number of water molecules in the cluster. Red is the aromatic system, and green is our triflic acid system. What we're seeing is substantial in all of the cases, particularly at the dissociation case at 3 water molecules, and both acids dissociate at 3 water molecules. We see substantial electron density in the aromatic system existing on the oxygen atoms. So in the context of organic chemistry, the aromatic system is the stronger Lewis base. Take-home lesson, if we want high conductivities at low water contents, we want weak Lewis bases, strong Lewis acids. Is this relevant to experimental information comparing the two membranes, peak and Nafion? Absolutely. Membranes prepared with minimal water, comparing the two, show much higher conductivities with the fluorinated systems. Key thing, at low water contents, high. What if we change from a sulfonic acid system to this acidemic system? Here, we got dissociation only after 3. Here, we have dissociation after only 2. Again, consistent with what we know about this acid from experimental measurements. All right. Now, I want to go to this dynamics section. So, this is on the hierarchy. This is number 2. Now, so you may have said, well, okay, he's talking about these small little fragments, and he seems to have some at least qualitative agreement with experiments, and we emphasize qualitative. We understand the limitations of the interpretation of this data. Now, what about dynamics? We've tried to rationalize in the previous calculations things on the basis of static minimum energy conformations. I do have some conviction and sense that this is pretty good. But let's try and look at some dynamics. Well, the system that we've chosen, it's a polymeric system now, is this triflic acid monohydrate solid. So this will be an analog of the Nafion system with very little water, say 1 water per sulfonic acid group. We know the reason we chose this solid is a well-established crystal structure. In the unit cell, there are 4 repeat units, and it's just slightly off a cubic system. Now we apply our ab initio molecular dynamics using this VASP or Viano ab initio simulation package, where we're going to start with the known structure. I mean, one of the problems with such a large system is where do you put your atoms to start with? Realizing that where you put them is very important in terms of what you're going to find. So we have this well-characterized solid. We're going to use periodic boundary conditions in three dimensions. So now, it's as if we've got a much larger system than simply those small, isolated fragments that we were talking about earlier. And we'll run not only minimum energy quenches, but we'll also run at two different ensembles, molecular dynamics, one at constant T and the other at constant E. Now, these calculations that I'm going to show you now, relative to this solid, just to understand the expense of this computationally, represent 80 CPU years of data on a single 450 megahertz processor. We used 40 processors in parallel for 2 years of continuous running to generate this information. And I make a point of that because to do these types of simulations, you're very much limited in terms of the step size between your configurations. We ran these for 40 picoseconds, and that's, you might say, well, 40 picoseconds, what could you possibly learn that's relevant in 40 picoseconds? Wait and see. We understand the limitations. Now, one of the ways of getting over this was to take five separate uncorrelated systems and run them simultaneously on our system. That helps us get good statistics and perhaps helps to convince the skeptics that you have something relevant. Now, when I see in the literature, and you see this occasionally now, people reporting simulation results for 2 or 4 picoseconds, I say that's ridiculous. You can't possibly know enough at that. Then, of course, you might say, well, even after 40, what can you know? Well, we've found something. So if we take a look at the native solid with this series of simulations, I would like to submit, here's a supercell of the unit cell. And in terms of trying to convince you its relevance to the polymeric system, take a look at what we have here. We have domains that contain water and ions that are well separated from the fluorine domain. So we have a channel, as it were, of water and ions. So we have something that's similar. Okay, now, starting from the native solid, running our simulations for all this length of time, we saw the occasional moving of the protons, but nothing very interesting. And this is one of the problems with doing this type of a simulation. How do you perturb the system? How do you explore it for relevant structures and dynamics when you're so limited in the time? Well, one of the things in this particular case, we could jack the temperature up and see what happens. In this particular case, what we did is we created an artificial defect. So on one of the protons in our system, we removed it, okay, from our solid, ran our dynamics. And what we saw, so we ran the same protocol on all five systems, and what we see is substantial distortion of the solid. So we've got a lot of stuff taking place here where clearly the regular domains are somewhat obstructed. Somewhat closer examination, well, then the obvious thing is to return the proton. We took the proton out, ran our dynamics, returned the proton back. We chose to return it to a sulfonate site, forming an acid, then did our same series of calculations, the quench in these constant temperature and constant energy simulations. And what we see here, so we had saw one of two things occur within these five separated simulations that we looked at. One was a return to the native structure, but the more interesting one was the formation of this stable defect. Defects in proton conduction in solids are very, very important. And this was the first time we were able to see this defect, and first time anyone reported this defect within this particular solid. What is the defect? Essentially what we have is we have delocalization of two protons in this defect, and we believe it's a stable defect because of the length of time that we ran the simulations. Two delocalized protons. One of the protons is delocalized between two sulfonate groups. And what do I mean by delocalized? I mean that on a time scale, which we'll see in the next slide, the proton is at one point with one sulfonate group and at the other point with the other sulfonate group, depending on what snapshot you take during the simulation. The other proton is delocalized between two water molecules. This is, and we heard something very brief about it yesterday, is the Zundel ion, the H5O2 plus ion, an ion that is known to play a very important role in the diffusion and proton transfer events in bulk water. Now, analysis of this defect. So here's our defect. two delocalized protons, H1 and H2. This is work that we've just done. If we look at the distances, the OO distances then, between these two fragments, and the OH distances, in red and blue, we have the delocalized OH distance in the Zundelein. Red is with respect to the Zundelein, and we see fluctuations in its distance, 1 to 1.5 angstroms, which means it's either with one water molecule or the other, on a time scale of about 2-3 femtoseconds. In blue, we have the delocalized, this OH distance for this hydrogen, and here we see that it is shuffled between the two, but on a much longer time scale. In fact, this is more like about 3 to 4 picoseconds. Well, that's all very interesting. What about the frequencies? So we calculated, there's several ways a person, at least two good ways I know, that you could calculate frequencies for these solids, and we want to compare the two, the native solid with then this defect that we found. One is through a velocity autocorrelation function. We chose to calculate the frequencies, omega, from the eigenvalues of this constructed fluctuation matrix, where delta x sub I is the deviation of an instantaneous position from its mean position during the simulation. Here is our native solid series of frequencies and intensities, power spectrum, and here's the defect. The importance is the formation, one of the important differences in these two is the formation of these soft modes in the defect. These are the modes for the delocalized protons. In terms of comparison to experimental information, we sought to calculate the difference in free energies to get a measure of the energy of activation for this defect state. And what we calculated, this is the Helmholtz free energy of formation, is a difference. The defect lies about 0.2 electron volts higher in energy. So, is this relevant to the polymeric system? To Nathium? Dow? Yes. Experimentalists tell us that the energy of activation for proton transport in minimally hydrated Nafion is about 0.3 electron volts. It varies a little bit, 0.3 to 0.4 electron volts. Our system is different. We wouldn't expect to get exactly the same. I'm not surprised. In fact, it's a confirmation that we have a slightly lower energy of activation because in the solid, we have the means of moving the sulfonates much more freely than if they're attached to a polymeric background and part of a side chain. But this tells us that this defect is very relevant when we're trying to understand proton conduction in minimally hydrated polymeric systems. A separate confirmation of this, which incidentally we tucked in, this is a whole series that follows on some of the earlier calculations we showed you. This is again going back to the static electronic structure calculations with the local basis at approximations. We tucked this in the Annual Review of Materials Research this year in an article, and this then is the Dow sidechain membrane with 6 water molecules. And the interest, and actually quite surprising result, this is why ab initio calculations, quantum, H psi equals E psi is the way to go, folks. What we see here is with 6 water molecules in the 2 sidechains, both protons dissociated, the formation of the hydronium ion, hydrogen bonded to one of the sulfonates and hydrogen bonded to the other water molecules. But most importantly in the back here is Mr. Zundel. Here is our delocalized proton between these 2 water molecules. Doesn't matter, you can push the proton over here and seek for the minimum energy conformation. Always heads back to here. Push it over to the other water molecule, the minimum energy conformation, according to the gradients that we impose, requirements of the gradients, will always end up in the center. Very significant result. So, even under minimally hydrated systems, the Zundelein has some role to play. This is the work of a substantial number of individuals, Tuckerman, Barks, Klein, and so on, ab initials, and also, I might say, Agmund, experimental work, on trying to understand proton transport in bulk water. And as we said before, the Zundelein, so what we have here is Zundel, Eigenzundel. Now, this is not the last word on this issue. It's still controversial. But this, I think, is a fairly reasonable picture of some of the important points in bulk water. We have the conversion from a Zundel to an Eigen to a Zundel that is accomplished with minimal barriers and somewhat over minimal time scales as a result of the outside or second hydration shell of these ions participating in the formation of hydrogen bonds to the inner species. Well, what we see in addition, so it is the rotation and formation of hydrogen bonds that facilitates this transfer, but what we see in the center regions, which you've highlighted in blue, is the retention of the symmetry of the proton. So whether it's in the Eigen ion, which is this larger so-called hydrated hydronium ion, or in the Zundel ions, we have this preservation of symmetry. Now, ideally, what you'd like, folks, in a polymeric membrane is a material that will exhibit the same proton conductivity as you get in bulk water. Natheon, fully hydrated, has a proton diffusion coefficient about 2 times 10 to the minus 5 centimeters per second. Bulk water has a value about 4.5 times that higher. And that's in the fully hydrated Natheon. Now, once you start to get lower, you're starting to fall off substantially. Okay, now we hit to this final section. We don't have a lot of time, but I want to hit this final section, which is where we do this bridging between what the experimentalists measure in a self-diffusion proton coefficient and what we can calculate using our statistical mechanics machinery. Now, you've probably heard me stress all this business of ab initio and so on and so on and so on. Now we have to make some approximations, and some phenomology will enter into our system. Now, what we're going to take a look at, this is our idealized pore. So for the moment, we'll consider, to say, the Natheon pore. This is our flooring material, a backbone material. And we'll look at a single pore. We'll put our sulfonate groups in. And for the moment, we'll distribute them along the pore symmetrically, the same distance. We'll assume that there is some intrusion length into the pore. We will assume we have essentially a cylinder with radial symmetry. And what we'll seek to do, put in our water molecules, put in our sulfonate groups, we will seek to calculate the proton self-diffusion coefficient. So it is, and why are we stressing self-diffusion? Because we do not impose an electric field in the system, just as they don't do when they do the experimental measurement of the self-diffusion coefficient. So we will seek to calculate the diffusion coefficient of this entity, and we'll assume for the moment it's a hydronium ion. We can relax that assumption, but we'll assume that it's something larger than simply a bare proton, because what we're interested in is long-term measurements and relevance to experiments. So this thing moves along the center of the pore for the moment, and we'll seek to calculate its diffusion coefficient. How do we do this? Well, here's an outline of our model. Recall that the Einstein relation gives us this inverse relationship between the diffusion coefficient, d sub alpha, which is our targeted hydronium ion. And I might say that the formalism that we're going to present is that which is after Rezeboy or Prigine. We don't see an awful lot of it in the literature today, though some folks are still pursuing it a little bit. At any rate, we are going to then seek to calculate this friction coefficient on the proton. What is a friction coefficient? A friction coefficient is that which relates in a linear sense the net force on something with its velocity. We'll be interested in a scalar because that's what's relevant in terms of comparing to experiment. We will make use of this in white, which is our statistical mechanics. It says, if we have a molecular force probe on the hydronium ion as it moves through the pore, the average, the ensemble average of that molecular probe will give us the relevant force for which then we can calculate this friction coefficient. Recalling that this average is a phase space integration, over that is over all the position, all the momentum of this molecular probe force with a suitably derived distribution function. So our problem becomes, if we're going to calculate diffusion coefficient, is setting up, computing a relevant distribution function for our system and also the molecular force. That's the project. All right, so in our system, in the pore, we'll have capital N water molecules, the single hydronium ion for the moment, and all of the sulfonate groups, which we'll just say are hanging present from the exterior of the pore. This is the equation you've seen. This is our time evolution equation. This will allow us a means, if we could, of course, solve it exactly, a means of calculating our distribution function that we need. It's the Liouville equation. Can't be solved, as I said before, except in trivial cases. So we'll make use of then just this formal solution. The formal solution says that the time-dependent distribution function is equal to the operation of a time displacement operator, which depends on our Liouville operator, on a t equals 0, or in this case, we'll assume it's an equilibrium distribution function. So we'll assume before the hydronium ion goes through the pore, everything's stationary, and our business then is if you can construct the Liouville operator for our system and this equilibrium distribution function, you should be able to get at this time-dependent non-equilibrium distribution function. So, the Liouville operator, of course, recall that it is computed from a Poisson bracket with the Hamiltonian for the system. And the Hamiltonian, of course, is that which is simply the sum of the potential and kinetic energies of the system. So we have to make some decisions. Easy to maybe deal with kinetics. Of course, we did make an assumption, which I didn't stipulate, is that relevant to the link scales of the proton or hydronium moving the system, we'll assume at first that our sulfonates are going to be stationary. That's just our first assumption. So it's a little bit like a Born-Oppenheimer approximation. The sulfonates don't move as much as the protons. So the relevance will be the movement of these water molecules and the consequence on the transport properties of the proton. Okay, so then our business then becomes what do you assume this potential energy should be? What are the relevant contributions to the potential energy for the system? We've broken up into four contributions that are two-body interactions. Let's say something about these. We have water interacting with the hydronium, which we'll take as a charged dipole. This is not the most sophisticated potential. You can probably think of some better ones, but we'll just assume that we can take this. So we'll just treat the water molecules as dipoles. And this is a time average contribution over the potential orientations of this dipole. In addition, we'll look at all the interactions of the sulfonate groups with the hydronium, and then the water-water interactions, treating them as dipole-dipole interactions, and then the sulfonate with the water. Our chairman is now rising from his seat. Okay, let's say something about this potential here. I want to say something about how one does this. And this work, interesting, was stumbled upon somewhat accidentally. There is an exact solution for how a person would treat one charge in the presence of a series of negative uniformly spaced charges if they were infinite distribution of these charges. That is this exact formulation. We'll take an approximation for our system. And then, all right, so then I want to say something about how we compute these distribution functions. All right, we're going to assume that at far distances away from the hydronium ion, so before she starts, at far distances away, we have an equilibrium. And this equilibrium, we can simply borrow the distribution of function appropriate for a canonical ensemble, constant NV and T. If we assume further the velocity of the hydronium ion is not that great, we can do a simple power series expansion where we retain only the zeroth and first order terms, thus simplifying our distribution function somewhat. So if we substitute it into this formal solution, this is the compact form of our desired distribution function for the calculation of this friction coefficient. Well, knowing something about where we have to go, which is we have to do these phase space integrations, we can further separate this into three terms. Noting that the first and the second terms, with respect to these integrations, will drop out because of symmetry, and we end up simply with this last term. Now, as a hydronium ion goes through the pore, there will be transits disturbing its environment. Some of them won't last very long, these disturbances. But the ones that will be important and contribute to the friction and then consequently the diffusion coefficient of the system are the long-term ones. So we'll take this limit as t goes to infinity of this distribution function and say that's going to be the relevant one for our transport model. All right, let's then cut to the chase here because of the time limitations. The friction coefficient then consists of four contributions. The nice thing about this model is that we have broken up our friction and consequent diffusion coefficient into four contributions. To understand, so what are these essentially? These are force-force correlation functions. We have our time displacement operator sandwiched between two forces. a pictorial representation of what we're seeing in distinction between these four terms is as follows. So we have water molecules in black, hydronium in blue, and the sulfonate in red. I want to say something about T1, then, is just the interaction. Name it's the same force on either side. It's just the interaction of the water with the hydronium ion. So as a first approximation, we will assume that this is a zeroth order friction coefficient, something that we won't use all our heavy-duty statistical mechanics to calculate, but we'll assume that based on the nature of the water in the pore, and consequent the hydration, we'll take one of two values. We'll say something more about that if we get a moment. The others express the result of interaction with these sulfonate groups. The fact that we have a pore, the fact that we have these anions, it's disturbing the water, it's constraining the water, and its consequent on the distribution function is important. Now, distinguishing the difference between T2 and T3 is the following. T3 is direct electrostatic interaction of the sulfonate groups, these anions, with both the hydronium and the water molecule. Here, T2 is a synergetic effect. Here it is only the sulfonate groups interacting with the water molecules, and then these constrained water molecules then interact with the hydronium ion to create some friction. Depending on the type of polymer, depending on the distribution of the sulfonate groups, depending on the amount of water, T2 and T3, the magnitudes relative to one another will change. We will find that under certain circumstances, T3 is the dominant interaction. And under other circumstances, T2 is the dominant interaction. The importance of this is we can tailor our polymer to give us minimal friction by our choice of the nature of these anions and their distribution. All right, we have very little time left. I'm going to skip over the work that we did on the nature of the water. Well, maybe just say one statement. It's important to understand the nature of the water in the system, even for the evaluation of those potentials. Previously, we had done, this is an experimental work, comes from two pieces of work we published a few years ago, this broadband high-frequency dielectric spectroscopy. The importance of probing this polymer prepared at different water contents, and this is a Nafion system, is that the Debye relaxation of bulk water occurs around 18 gigahertz, so we were forced to look at this system with a very, very broad band spectroscopy. In fact, it's gigahertz. It's microwave region up to 30 gigahertz at the end. The importance from this lesson is that these are the number of water molecules per sulfonate, so we've got increasing hydration, is we see distinction even between lambda equals 2 and lambda equals 4. Jay's result, with his fuel cell, the difference between whether you've got almost two or whether you don't have two waters per sulfonate caused an ignition or failure to ignite the fuel cell. Here we see even differences in the dielectric constant, and believe you me, it makes a difference in the performance of or the resulting proton conduction. Well, the drawback in these types of measurements is that this is a bulk dielectric constant. It's a dielectric constant of not only the water, which we're seeing the differences because the polymer is the same, but also of the polymer. If we really want to get at the dielectric constant of only the water, we then did this piece of work, and perhaps Professor Paul will say more about it this afternoon, is our derivation of a permittivity or dielectric constant that depends on the pore. Recalling that such an equation, standardly used, and we saw the consequences of it in the Poisson equation yesterday, is very much a macroscopic equation. And so how a person gets at a essentially microscopic permittivity is a difficult problem. This equation says if we probe a material with an electric field, it responds to that electric field. If it responds easily to an alternating electric field, epsilon will be high, and if it does not, it will be low. Recall that the field-dependent dielectric constant may be partitioned into these two terms, one which depends on the refractive index, and more importantly, one which depends on this ratio of the polarization of the material and the applied electric field. We will use this relation coming from statistical thermodynamics to calculate this polarization, namely the functional derivative of the Helmholtz free energy with respect to the electric field. So our problem becomes, how do you put together the Helmholtz free energy of the system. Not an easy problem. And it's not an easy problem. Historically, we see efforts in the literature dating back to 1950, one or so of Booth. But the problem in our system is we have already existing in the system a strong electric field that is there because of the presence of the sulfonate groups. And so how we consider that energy is very important in what we're going to see. Let me cut to some of the results here. Here we have poor permittivity, so that's the water dielectric constant. Natheon at three different water contents, where on the horizontal axis we plot the distance